This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we're featuring interviews with performers inducted last night into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Neil Young is one of the few musicians whose early records are played on classic rock stations, but whose new records remain vital and exciting. To quote the Rolling Stone Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll, Young is sometimes visionary, sometimes flaky, sometimes both at once. Neil Young was born in 1945 in Toronto, spent much of his youth in Winnipeg. In 1966, he moved to L.A. and teamed up with Stephen Stills and Richie Furay to form the group Buffalo Springfield. After the band split up in 1968, Young formed his own band Crazy Horse and then did a stint with Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Over the years, he's played acoustic music, country rock, and hard-driving rock. Before we hear an excerpt of a 1992 interview with him, let's hear his recording, The Needle and the Damage Done.
I caught you knocking at my cellar door. I love you, baby, can I have some more? Ooh, the damage done. I hit the city and I lost my band. I watched the needle take another man. Gone, gone. Damage done. I sing the song because I love the man. I know that some of you don't understand. Milk blood to keep from running out. I've seen the needle and the damage done. A little part of it in everyone. But every junkie's like a setting sun.
You were in high school bands. Did you sing in those bands?
After the beginning, I did. I started as an instrumentalist. We used to do songs, instrumentals that I used to write, you know, melodies and play them on the guitar, sort of like a group called The Shadows from England. And then after the English invasion, you know, and and also about the same time as Jimmy Reed became popular, the old blues man, Jimmy Reed, with going to New York and...
Bright Lights, Big City.
Yeah, Beeping and Hiding and all these things. You know, about the same time as the British invasion, all these groups singing harmony and playing guitars and everything. Both of those things happened to me at once, so I really couldn't figure out who it was that made me want to sing, but one of them, you know, or both of them at the same time. Then I started singing, and that was... like a milestone.
What do you mean?
People couldn't believe it, apparently. I don't remember it, but I was so into it, I guess I didn't notice that everybody was going, what is that? You know, as I was starting to sing. Of course, now I'm like, you know, Caruso or something. Got it down.
Were you self-conscious about your voice when you started to sing?
No, not really. I never really, I was just glad to be singing. I mean, we could do a lot more songs if I sang them.
No one else in the band could sing?
No. Nobody in the band could sing. Not nobody else in the band. Nobody in the band. So we did harmony, and we did everything, you know, but it didn't matter.
Now, you say that you weren't self-conscious about your singing, but there's stories about how, you know, like in your first solo album, you intentionally mixed yourself in the background.
No, I mixed myself right up there where I should be, and then they tried out this new scientific process that they'd invented called the CSG Heiko-Cog process, which is... this unbelievable thing where you can make a stereo record play back on a mono machine just like it was a mono record. They did something to the sound back then. This is when stereo was just coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, you know, a lot of people had mono sets and the stereo didn't sound right on the mono set. So they came out with this thing. You run it through this machine that this guy made, this little box or something. And it would make it so you could play it both stereo or mono. But in reality, I was a test case for this with my first album. They did this without letting me know. And they put it out like that, and I got the pressings back, and I went, what happened, you know? Then I read this thing that had been added on the album cover where this, with this engineering note that this had employed this technique. And really, it was the worst thing I ever heard. I mean, they just buried the whole center of the record and put it way down. And this, I think they only used it on my record. They decided it didn't work after that.
So it, it wasn't self-consciousness that was behind
it? No. I can look at the next record. My vocal is right up there.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about being in a tight harmony group like Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young?
How did they feel about it? That's the question. It was no longer a tight harmony group.
Do you like being in a harmony like that? I mean, I love your voice. I consider it a very personal voice. Do you know what I mean? A voice that should be singing on its own more so than just like mixed in a harmony.
Well, you know, I like singing harmony too. I sing good harmony with Crazy Horse.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sense in there that, you know, because there's a couple of different ways to sing harmony, you know, and you can, or blends of all of them. But one of them is just real tight harmony, and the other one is where everybody's singing just more or less just singing loose, but in a harmonic structure with a lot of feeling. That's a different kind of harmony, and that's the kind of harmony that I do with Crazy Horse quite a bit. Sometimes we're real successful at that.
We're featuring a 1992 interview with Neil Young. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Neil Young. So you came from Canada to Los Angeles, became part of Buffalo Springfield, and I guess it was in 1966 you have a really big hit, For What It's Worth. And then, you know, people just like love Buffalo Springfield. This is like the height or the beginnings of the height of the whole kind of counterculture, which is really thriving, particularly on the West Coast. And so suddenly, like, you're really in the thick of it. I mean, you'd gone from what, a small town in Canada, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a 500,000 people, something like that.
Uh-huh. And now, like, you're really in the thick of it. Did you change a lot? Were you, like, a kind of different person than you were?
Well, you know, I think it affected me. I think it got to be a lot of pressure for a while. But, you know, we got through that after freaking out and quitting the band a couple of times and, you know, throwing my guitar against the chair and doing all kinds of stuff. You know, we went through a normal kind of teenage to adult changeover period there.
When you throw your guitar against the chair, do you, in the days when you did that, was it, were you sure you had money to replace it?
No, that was the
point.
Before
you threw it?
No. No, I think I didn't do that every day, but it's just part, I guess, the pressure of being in the band and trying to make things happen. Yeah. We did a lot of things like that. I mean, what, we were 20, 21 years old. We were kind of crazy for a while, and then, you know, just like anybody else under a lot of pressure. Bunch of kids, and, you know, it was a pretty fast-moving time.
What's something that you look back on and still find really exciting about that period?
Well, the music was great. And it's too bad it was never recorded correctly, or the Buffalo Springfield would have been far more of a memory than they are now.
What's missing?
The music is missing. There was, you know, this was about the time when people started making records by overdubbing, and new technology was coming in. We had like 8 tracks, and we had ways of doing things that weren't that made it possible to layer records. And so instead of going in the studio and singing live, like we were so great live, the people producing us, they didn't record us the way they should have. If they had just set us up and let us record live, this band would be, band probably would have been together and stayed together a lot longer, because we would have had much more success and had a lot more happiness from listening to our records and, you know, felt like we were getting something done. But at the beginning, it was kind of hard to break through. We still didn't know how to make records, and we didn't have anybody that knew how to make records helping us make records. And instead, we had people who wanted to be record producers for one reason or another who were there, but they really weren't doing anything. Nobody strong came along and said, "Listen, you guys go in there and sing, and when I tell you to come out and stop playing and singing, then come on in here and it'll sound great." Nobody ever did that. So I feel that was a failing of the Buffalo Springfield, was all the records. There was only Ahmed Erdogan really had a grip on what should be what the Springfield records should sound like.
What sounds best to you now from those records?
I don't have a favorite.
Okay. I thought I'd play Mr. Soul. What are your memories of that?
Well, the memories of that are the best take of it and the best mix of it and the best version of it is somewhere in the Atlantic vault.
Right.
And the one that we're listening to here is one that where we got away from it and we kept overdubbing and overdubbed guitar parts and added things over top of the original stuff and lost some of the original stuff. And we took it too far. We didn't have anybody to tell us to go home or tell us that had experience telling us what to do. So we lost a lot of the great stuff that we had on tape in the first place, or that we never got a lot of it on tape at all.
Okay, well, in the meantime, we'll satisfy ourselves with the actually released version of Mr. Soul. Our interview with Neil Young was recorded in 1992. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame last night.